Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the kickoff event for Silicon Valley Reads 2013, presented by the Santa Clara County Office of Education, the Santa Clara County Library, San Jose Public Library Foundation, and the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. My name is Judy Kleinberg, and I'm the program director for, in Silicon Valley for the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, which supports transformational ideas that promote quality journalism, advance media innovation, engage communities, and foster the arts. We believe that democracy thrives when people and communities are informed and engaged. And so we're especially proud to again be one of the major sponsors of Silicon Valley Reads. And it's really my distinct pleasure to introduce the authors of this year's Silicon Valley Reads selections, Brian Kastner and Sue Diaz. Brian Kastner served three tours of duty in the Middle East as an explosive ordnance disposal officer for the U.S. Air Force, and one of his primary responsibilities was detonating roadside bombs, and he later received the Bronze Star for his service. After leaving the military, Brian became a consultant, training other Marine and Army Corps units that were later deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. Brian lives in Buffalo, New York, with his wife and four sons, and he's the author of The Long Walk, A Story of War and the Life That Follows, and leads writing workshops around the country. Sue Diaz is an award-winning journalist, author, and proud military mother. When her son Roman, who is a Purple Heart veteran, was deployed in Iraq, Sue began chronicling the war and her family's experiences in a nationally and internationally syndicated Christian Science Monitor series. Her immensely personal and emotional stories served as the starting point for her book, Minefields of the Heart, A Mother's Stories of a Son at War. Since 2007, Sue has been conducting writing workshops for veterans at the San Diego Vet Center, the Naval Medical Center, and Veterans Village of San Diego. She also provides a place on her website for veterans from across the country to write and share their own stories. Moderating tonight's conversation is the very wonderful Mike Cassidy, our columnist for the San Jose Mercury News. And so please join me in extending a really warm welcome for Brian Kastner, Sue Diaz, and Mike Cassidy.
Thanks for coming out tonight. They took away that big microphone from me because I was having a lot of trouble with it. But I do want to thank you all for being here. Here we are back in the Heritage Theater, which is a beautiful place, a great place to talk about books. It kind of reminds me of a library, particularly if you want to stare at the ceiling. It's sort of like one of those old WPA libraries. So it's an appropriate setting, and it so happens we have two really great books to talk about tonight. Together, Brian Kastner and Sue Diaz have given us a 360-degree look at the horrors of war. They've sort of put the two pieces of the puzzle together for us. They show us vividly what life is like for those who go off and fight for our country, and what life is like for those who stay behind and worry about them. And most importantly, I think, what they show us is that for the warriors, the battles rage on long after the war is over. I think in years past, I've talked about how it takes courage to write a book, to put your work out there and put yourself out there. Obviously, our selections this year, it took a whole different type of courage to write these books and to live the lives that wrote these books. It's really in a class by itself. And that said, I think maybe tonight how we might start is by taking a minute to show our appreciation for all those who volunteer to serve our country and for all those who support them from afar. So for those of you live tweeting this event, or a lot of tweeters out there, I bet, we'll use hashtag, who is that idiot up there talking to those two smart authors? No, really, hashtag SB Reads will do, if you're so inclined. So with all that out of the way, now we get to the good part. And I thought it might make sense just to start by talking a little bit about what it was that caused you to write these books, where these books came from. And I know you were arm wrestling in the back for who gets to go first, but
right.
Maybe we'll start with Brian.
I do remember the moment when I thought I might have a book here that other people might want to read, or a story that might be interesting for other people. And it wasn't... I started writing notes down in therapy with my shrink on the mental health floor of the VA hospital, but nobody wants to read the assembled scribblings that come from those kind of sessions. That's not a story. That's just, I don't know, that's just the churning of ideas. So I did, on one of my runs, I was about 8 miles into a 10-mile run, and I remember when I put my foot down and said, you know what, as I work my way through this, I'd say about, I don't know, halfway, two-thirds of the way through the process, maybe I could put this in a narrative that would make sense to me and then also make sense to other people. I should say, by the way, that after that, things kept happening. So I was living my life and writing a book, and things would happen in my life, and then I would sit down right away and write them out. And maybe a good example is from the book, my son's hockey game, the championship of the Mites there, and getting him dressed and the feelings I had there. That was well into the writing process. I left that game, came home, and typed it all out.
Wow. Well, we're glad you did. How about you, Sue? Yeah.
Well, actually, I mean, the book started, I might say, many, many years ago. I wrote a slice of life humor column, of all things, for a local parenting magazine. And all the time that my kids were growing up, I think from the time that Roman was 6 years old through, middle school through high school, and I chronicled, our family life.
Betty
and
loved
I just,
that.
I wrote
particularly okay. Right about middle school.
Right. And so it was natural for me to continue this story, since I had been doing it from the time that he was in first grade. So it was a normal continuation. I love essays, and I'm really drawn to the personal essay. I really admire the work of people like Anna Quinlan and Ellen Goodman and Charles Kuralt, and essayists and people who just write short pieces about, parts of life. So when Roman joined the Army, it was just natural to write about that and to continue writing about it. But, it has, of course, a very different tone than the humor column that I had been writing all those years. But for me, real life is the stuff that I love to write about. So, yeah. And so it just, I continued to do that. And then I saw the pieces that I had written for the Christian Science Monitor. I looked at all of them together, and there was really a narrative thread. But the book is larger than that, and in putting the book together, I mean, I thought it's both sort of lighter and darker than the pieces that were originally appeared in the
newspaper. Yeah, there is, it was a moving but tough assignment to read these two books, and that's probably a good thing, but there were flickers of humor that, certainly came through in both cases. But one thing that struck me, as a father, was reading about Roman's decision to join the Army when he talked to you about it. And I was just trying to think, our daughter just left in the fall for college. Of course, went halfway across the country. But that's a place where you... You get pretty nice rooms now. You get much better food than you used to. Presumably, nobody is shooting at you. You know, and yet I was a wreck just having that. And I couldn't imagine what it's like to have your kid tell you, I'm going in the Army, and I'd actually like to get into the part of the Army where you really fight and stuff. And I'm just wondering what that day was like, or that probably series of discussions.
Well, I think a lot of times I sort of fooled myself into thinking that it wasn't going to be as dangerous as it turned out to be. And when he first, you know, when he signed up for the Army, his first deployment or his first assignment was with the 1st Armored Division in Germany. And I thought at that time, oh, good, Germany. You know, he'll be visiting the capitals of Europe and and maybe, you know, just doing things there. And I even went, after he signed up, I even went to a recruiter once and said, now, you know, if he's there, he'll be safe. He won't be, you know, he won't be part of this Middle East stuff that was brewing at the time. And the recruiter said, oh, yeah, he'll be safe. So, but I think... I think as a parent, you do that. I mean, you denial can be a very helpful thing sometimes.
Yeah, it's particularly in a case like that.
Yeah.
Did you try to talk him out of it, or?
Oh, I did. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I tried to bribe him actually.
Yes.
because in the book, I mentioned that whole incident, and he. He said, you know, I signed up for the infantry, and he could have had any job in the Army. His test scores were really good. And he said, but, you know, because you get this $10,000 bonus. And, I said, there's a reason for that, Roman. And at that time, I had a CD that was an inheritance from an aunt. And I said, you know, I'll give you that as a bonus for not joining the infantry. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that so much that I was like anti-military or anti-armed services, but the infantry, you know, that's the tip of the spear. Those are the people that carry the guns. Those are the people that do the fighting. And as a mom, that's a very hard thing.
But it obviously wasn't just the bonus that had him have his eye on the infantry.
Yeah, well, I think there was a certain amount of adventure, and he wanted to be where the action was, I think.
Mm-hmm. Brian, why did you decide to serve initially?
Well, I guess my recruiter told many of the same stories as you heard.
This is shocking.
Right. Recruiters have a tough job, but everybody in the military has the same story that their recruiter lied to them. I wanted to be an astronaut.
Uh-huh.
And my recruiter looked at my glasses here and said, yeah, absolutely, you can do that. and so I applied for an ROTC scholarship, and I applied for the Air Force because that seemed to make the most sense. And they said, do electrical engineering, and that would, okay, I guess that kind of makes sense. And it took me a couple years before I realized that being an astronaut was not in my future, but... The funny thing was that once I actually got in, I got commissioned, became a second lieutenant, and started my first job, I loved it from day one. It's like, it was almost like joining a second time.
Uh-huh.
You know, that I knew that this is what I wanted to do, and then you have to volunteer to go to Explosive Ordnance Disposal School. That's the bomb squad. I mean,
they could use a little marketing help with that
right.
name, but...
Yeah, it's a mouthful, yeah. I guess. Yeah, EOD is how we skip to it. But, you know, so in some ways I was volunteering again, and by then it was after 9/11. I knew exactly what I was signing up for. I knew the kind of work I was going to be doing, and that was the draw. And 18 to 22-year-old men have been volunteering for the military for thousands of years.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It's part of the hormones and the... adventure and proving something to yourself and transitions to manhood and all of those things.
And bomb disposal, I mean, I could see a real challenge and fascination, but I think you were married, you had a kid or kids.
I did. I had one and another on the way. My wife was pregnant when we went down to school. Right, and so I guess as a 30, 40... 50-year-old man, you'd look back on that and say, and see these responsibilities and the You know, should you be volunteering for that? I'm not sure I could volunteer for it at 35 now, but at, what was I, 23, 24 or something, it was, I didn't think about it the same way I do now, certainly.
Well, I don't know that it matters or would have mattered, but it, as you described in the book, the job also changed somewhat, and I'm sure your understanding of the job changed as it went on.
It did. I mean, how many people had heard of IEDs before 2002, 2003, or 4 or something, you know? So we had in the military, but they were pipe bombs. They were things from the Unabomber. It certainly wasn't the weapon that it became. And so I thought I was signing up for, well, certainly a job in the front, but not, well, I mean, not what it turned into. Nobody expected what the war became.
Right. Well, in both of your books, you talk about, you know, the worst days, both your experiences, again, on the two sides of this puzzle. And Brian, you had a stretch of days in Iraq that I think, as you described it, it was the 3 days that broke you. And it culminated in the confrontation with the guy in the truck who wouldn't get out of the truck. And there were a couple of really bad days before that. Can you talk about that a bit and talk about, maybe I'm making it overly dramatic, but how a stretch of 36, 48, whatever hours can be the real point at which you feel broken or felt broken?
I think it says something funny about the human brain or memory that I didn't realize the incidents of those 3 days happened in order until years later when I went back and I looked at my journals and kind of pieced together what had happened and only then realized how it worked. So on the first day, we did a raid on what we thought was a factory of IEDs, where it turned out not to be, and then probably in retaliation for that raid, where we arrested a lot of guys and tore a lot of stuff up, we had what we eventually called the Day of Six V-Beds, a V-Bed being a vehicle-borne IED, a car bomb. We had six in 15 minutes, five of them detonated and one didn't, and I was there as we managed to take apart the one that didn't. And then by the third day, we had more V-Beds, but in this case, something didn't feel right. The driver got shot, but they didn't kill him. He was stuck in the truck. And it ended up being one of my guys who eventually shot him after he got out and he wouldn't follow directions, and they thought he was a suicide bomber. It's at the time I had been on my tour for a couple weeks, and it ended up being a lull. You don't know that at the time. These 3 days were some of the most intense of the tour, and they happened very quickly. And just one thing after another, I felt burned out and exhausted immediately. I felt like the speaker out of out of your car stereo, if you crank it all the way up and just play it till it breaks, you know. I kind of stumbled through a bunch of the rest of the tour, and by the end of it, I mean, I barely remember the last couple months.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's like being beaten over the head with a hammer. Emotionally, it just deadened you. It was kind of like a welcome to Iraq. And that was actually my second tour, but it was that much different. The war had changed that much. It had gotten that much worse. More, by worse, I mean more IEDs, more attacks, more deaths, more everything. And so it was, I don't know, that much more than before.
Were there strategies in country that you had, or people you served with had what would you do to
smoke a lot of cigarettes and put in a lot of dip and try to get some sleep and then wake up and do it all over again? because what else are you going to do? I have my sister-in-law is a psychologist, And she, when I told her about one of these incidents, she said, "Oh, you need to get your team together, and you should sit down in group and talk about it, and then, you know, a week later talk about it, and then we could do some individual." And it's like, well, we did three of those that day, and then we'll do three the next day, and the three the day after that. There's no
not a lot of time for group.
There's no time for this. So you just eat some cold chicken nuggets from the chow hall and try to sleep. Mm.
And Sue, your day, I mean, among many, but just before Christmas in 05, I think, you got that phone call that you wrote about. And what was that like to get that call, and sort of what was the aftermath of that for you?
The call that he's talking about is when we heard that our son was injured by an IED. And you know, it's a call that you never forget. There were things that I learned about that incident actually afterwards, and I was so glad that I didn't know then what I know now. There's another book that's written about my son's platoon called Black Hearts, One Platoon's Descent into Madness in Iraq's Triangle of Death. And it's rather extraordinary, actually, that as a parent, I kind of know what my son experienced, not really from him directly, but through this book. And these two books, my book and this book, Black Hearts, they were written, we didn't know that the other person was writing the book. And together, I mean, they offer, you talked about a 360 view, but this is of one platoon.
Right.
So you know, and that particular platoon, it was as bad as things can possibly get in a war situation. They were patrolling between Mahmoudiya and Yusufiya, which was, I think, south of Baghdad in that area known as the Triangle of Death. And at that time, they had a battalion, which I think is like 1,000 men in that area covering that. And it was a hotbed of the insurgency. 2 years later, they had 30,000 men there. So while my son was there, there were things like they would experience at least, that battalion would experience about 100 attacks per week. And in the course of the year, they encountered over 900 IEDs.
That was amazing.
So it was a very, very difficult situation. And I learned later that the IED incident and the one that my son was involved in, reading Jim Frederick's book, I learned he wrote that bomb, the four soldiers were on foot patrol, and they were all walking, you know, relatively together, and the bomb, that explosion was heard 10 miles away. It was that big. And Jim Frederick writes in the book, all four men should have died. And it's rather extraordinary, really, to have that insight into what my son experienced in that depth and in that detail.
And then, so you dread the phone ringing or someone coming to your door?
Oh, sure. I mean, that's something. And it's something that I hadn't realized. If someone has someone who's serving, you know, in a combat zone especially, never visit them, never ring their doorbell without first calling, without first letting them know. I mean, any time while my son was there, when the doorbell would ring, I can't tell you how, you know, what a long walk that would be from whatever part of the house you were, you know, if you weren't expecting someone. And, you know, even Girl Scouts selling cookies, what are you doing, you know? A bit of advice there.
So what happens with that call, you know, on that day? How does that work?
Well, they called and they said, this is, we know, actually, I could read you that section. Or part of it, anyway.
This doesn't excuse you from reading it yourself.
Okay. Let's see. Where is that? Okay. Let me see. Is this Susan Diaz, a man's voice said when I answered the phone in my home office. I had just finished feeding SpongeBob in the bedroom down the hall. SpongeBob was my son's pet turtle.
We'll get to that.
The voice on the other end sounded like a telemarketer, and I replied with a wary, "Yes, this is Susan Diaz. Is your husband there?" "He's not available at the moment," I said, rather than offer that he'd left for work an hour earlier and that I was home alone. The man, all business, introduced himself, Captain Kandrian, 101st Airborne, and then went on to say that our son had, quote, sustained injuries caused by an IED. I sat down slowly. "That's an improvised explosive device, ma'am." No need for that extra bit of information. Those three letters had become as familiar as PTA used to be. Above the thumping of my heart, I heard Captain Kandrian relate the details of what he called the incident. I switched the phone to my left hand, reached for the yellow legal pad I always keep handy, fumbled for a pen, and wrote down these words: perforated eardrum, peppered face, treated at the aid station at Al Mamoudia. "Could you spell that, please?" I heard myself say. Mamoudia is what I wanted spelled. In everyday circumstances, I can be as ditzy as anyone. Ask my husband how many times he's heard, "Seen my glasses anywhere?" But in this situation, my mind was surprisingly focused, as if spelling the aid station's name correctly could somehow make right the news that Captain Kandrian was telling me. "Does this mean Roman will get to come home?" I asked, hoping. "No, ma'am. His injuries are listed here as not serious." I wrote down "not seriously injured" in big block letters. I underlined those words three times and drew a box around them. "Your son should be back with his unit soon, but you might not hear from him for a few days because of the news blackout over there." And he rushed through that last part of the sentence. "News blackout? What do you mean?" The captain explained reluctantly that when soldiers from a unit have been killed, no one from that group is allowed to phone or email until the next of kin have been notified. "Oh," I murmured as that sunk in, "some soldiers died in the attack?" "Yes, ma'am." "Do you know their names?" "Yes, ma'am, but I can't tell you that." And I thought about the almost paternal affection I'd heard in Roman's voice during his last leave when he talked about the guys in his fire team. In the months at Fort Campbell before being deployed, he'd shared dinner at the homes of some of them, played cards with their parents, met their wives, high-fived their kids. "It's up to me now to make sure they all come home," Roman said of the men he'd been assigned to lead. I think I'll stop there.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole machinery and a process and a lot of rules that are in place for good reason. But that's a horrible thing to, when you most want to talk to your child, you know it's going to be quite a while and probably seem like an eternity.
Mm-hmm. And then Roman was upset when he learned that they had called us. I mean, I think there's something when people are over there, you want to protect the people that you love on the other side.
Right. You just, I mean, I wouldn't send details home, and I mean, I couldn't send many details home, but I mean, we would have comm blackouts regularly, and at least you want to send something to say, "Hey, it's not me, don't worry about it," whatever else. But truth is, I mean, somebody died on the news every night.
Yeah.
So there could always be a reason, you know, that your wife or mother or spouse or whatever was worried. I wanted to say real quick, by the way, one part from her reading is how easily IED comes instead of PTA. I was also thinking, you know, foot patrol and Mumbadia and Yusuf, you know, all those other towns kind of trip off your tongue as well. These are the things you learn when your son is a soldier. You know, all those, and I can vouch, Mumbadia is one of the special kind of evil down in that place.
Yeah.
Well, I was sure that would all resonate with you, and probably in even some technical ways, understanding that, you know, IED is a very blunt instrument, but there's a wide range of them, and what they do and how they might affect a particular individual can be a roll of the dice, I suppose.
Yeah, it doesn't, I mean, this isn't a very happy answer, but people sometimes ask, you know, why this happens, why one guy died and another guy didn't die, or, I mean, that's really the heart of survivor's guilt, is asking yourself, why me and not, why someone else, and war taught me that there is no answer to that question. It's all luck, or even worse than luck. It's just, I mean, it's simply meaningless. And so why, you know, I have friends that died because they did go out when they weren't supposed to. Then there's other guys who lived because they were supposed to and they didn't. And then it detonates over here. It doesn't detonate over there. I had one detonate relatively close to me. I happened to be, you know, on the right side of my truck, so it caught the frag. I mean, you could spend all day asking why each of these things happened the way they did, but there's no answer. Hmm. At least not one that I found sufficient.
You know, this is kind of right around something I was wondering about as I was reading certain things that you wrote, Brian, about, you describe preparing for war as incomparably lovely, which I thought was a great line. And talking about how you were, you wanted to make sure you got to Iraq before all the fun was over. You talked about, how everything, you wrote everything about Iraq sucked and how you loved it.
Right.
And that, and like when you talk about, was it your sister or sister-in-law, why don't you have a group session? I mean,
right.
It really underlines this disconnect that's a potential disconnect that can be very difficult for those of us who have never served or have never been in combat or have never known anyone really close to us in combat to figure out how does that work? I think I get what you're saying, but how...
Right.
How could you have those feelings?
I think there's a couple things there. One is you have worked very, very hard and trained very hard to do a particular job. And if you went to medical school and then never saw a patient, how would that feel? You would have this... You obviously don't want anybody to be sick, and you don't want anybody to get in a car wreck, but if you're a trauma surgeon... And you've worked really hard and you're trained, then you want to eventually do that. So that's part of it. But I think part of the preparation and what really lulls you into that is you get these group of guys, men and women. One of the funny things about the ban on women in combat being lifted is that there have been women in combat for...
Yeah.
Over a decade, right? And, I served with many of them. So, you're with these men and women, and you're spending all of your time together. You've gone somewhere. You're training together. You're shooting and driving trucks and blowing stuff up. And you were bonded before because you're all EOD techs, but you now have taken this to this other level, and your family is going to war. Any of those protective feelings you would have are magnified. And then the idea that when you've been trained to do this, you've worked really hard at it, you've got a group of people together that you're really close to, and then when you're actually doing it, I mean, there is this goes to that everything about Iraq sucked and I loved it. I mean, it's like climbing a mountain or a really hard workout or take your pick. There's something about the rigor of the challenge that makes it that much more satisfying. If war were easy, I was about to say it might be less fun, and that sounds terrible. And looking back on it, I mean, I don't feel that way now, but when I was going, that was certainly
right.
The truth.
Right. And, speaking of conflicted feelings or complicated feelings, Sue, you were opposed to the war in Iraq. I don't know where you are now, but even attended a rally that you wrote about and that sort of thing. I don't know if I'd call it a rally, but a vigil.
Kind of
And so I'm wondering, how did you work through that? I'd be interested to hear how do you work through that? And I'm sure you supported Roman. And how does all that work?
Well, it's possible to hate the war and love the soldier. It's possible to hate the war and support the troops. And I think the answer is just as simple as that. I don't know if I can really elaborate on that.
It certainly makes sense.
Yeah.
But was it ever a bone of contention or a point of argument between you and Roman? Or?
No. And I don't really think that for soldiers in a war zone that the politics become all that important. I think it's just, I think what becomes important is the men that they serve with And that's who they fight for while they're there, I think.
It's a cliche that you get out of the trench for the guy next to you, but that doesn't stop it from being true.
No.
You know, and I sometimes get asked about my political views of the war, the other guys that men and women I served with, and my disappointing answer is we never talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about whether your rifle was clean or getting the truck ready for the next day or, you know, what was the thing trying to kill you that day, not some speech given on either side in Washington. You know, that wasn't, it just didn't enter in.
Right. No, that's interesting. And maybe another sign of a disconnect, you know, that you're there, right? So you're there. That's sort of the thing to focus on.
I mean, again, your people are trying to kill your family.
Yeah.
And so you do everything you need to do to keep them alive, and then, you know, you all come home,
yeah.
Hopefully.
Now, I don't want this to get awkward at all, but have you read each other's book, or have either of you
yes.
read?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, all right.
You have, that could have been really bad, but that worked out fine.
Every now and then you just got to take a flyer. do you have thoughts about it?
I have to tell you, I mean, there were... Brian's book is an excellent book, and it really was eye-opening for me. I think I learned a lot about really what PTSD feels like, and I appreciated that. And the thing that you had mentioned in the beginning, that one scene where you're putting your son into his hockey uniform,
right.
and then end that by saying that you had put him, you had described the things that someone going to disarm a bomb, you know, the,
right.
the gear that they have to wear, and then the parallel between that. That scene just took my breath away. It really did. I mean, just as a mother, it was so understated and beautifully done.
Thank you. I have to say, I really appreciate Sue's book because I was completely unable to provide that kind of perspective myself. I could barely represent the feelings of my children. I didn't really feel right representing the feelings of my wife, Jessie. I had a really hard time putting words in her mouth, much less, you know, what my mother was feeling. And so I think there's just a great service there. When I joined ROTC, I was 17, so my mother had to sign the forms
right.
to say I was allowed to. And then when the invasion of Iraq was starting, we got into a very heated argument. I remember well where I was on Roman's side and my mm-hmm. wife was, or my mother, I should say, was on yours, you know. And so, we had that discussion once, but then never again. And I can only imagine what she was thinking watching the news, and now I know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Sue's done a great service.
Well, that's great. And it's true... You write about crazy nobody I've really read. I mean, it is, when I talk about that divide, that does somehow get me there to what a helpless, panicky feeling this can be, and yet that there's still an awareness that things are not going right, but it's not necessarily in my control in this moment to make them right. It was very powerful.
You know, being a bomb tech, you tend to have control issues. You know, you tend to be just a touch OCD, and so yeah, the helplessness was the worst part. And if I spent so much time trying to describe what the crazy feeling felt like because I needed to explain it to myself, and I couldn't find a word that worked. So
mm-hmm.
maybe if I could have been more succinct, I would have been. But I felt like every vignette was, I don't know, again, trying to explain it to the reader and trying to explain it to myself.
No, it was very, very effective. And I do remember thinking at the beginning, you know, where, forgive me, I won't quote it exactly right, but the first line is something like, I'm crazy.
Right.
And then there's a little discussion about how, you know, you don't tell everybody, only certain people. And I was thinking, well, I think the cat's kind of out of the bag.
Right. Yeah, well, you kind of have to make a choice. So, right.
But, I mean, maybe more seriously... Was it difficult to write the book in terms of how much of yourself you exposed, and in maybe to some in an extension, maybe the people you served with, your family a little bit, but
yeah,
I always got the sense there's not a code of silence, but there is this family, and there, you know, there are certain things the family talks about and other people don't.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, because there's two different answers to that. For the guys that I served with, I was much more worried about them, and I asked their permission, as many guys as I could get a hold of, which was nearly all of them. And we talked about it. There's actually a tradition in the EOD world that when your name appears in a newspaper, that you owe a case of beer to the unit. And, I mean, partly we like drinking beer, but the other part is it encourages you to just shut your mouth.
Yeah.
You know, you just, nobody needs to know about what we're doing. And, of course, I broke that rule in the worst possible way. So I owe beer for the rest of my life. But I was really conscious about getting their parts right and being fair to them and not exposing too much and trying to be not overly descriptive about who they were, using one word and trying not to, you know, pin anybody down. For myself, though, I was just extremely naive because I didn't know any different. I just wrote it all out. And I did not expect to be sitting on this stage talking to you about it, you know. So I didn't have the reticence because I thought I was going to print out one copy, save it for my sons. Nobody would buy the book. It wouldn't go anywhere. At least I got it done and then, you know, move on with getting a real job.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. So. Oh, thank you. I do have my kids do tell me when I'm agonizing over a column, "Well, don't worry about it, Dad. Nobody reads that stuff anymore."
Right, right.
And Sue, part of there were sections of your book that made me feel, I guess self-conscious is the word, or I hope not defensive. I wouldn't think so. But there are, you know, where you ran into not really a friend, but an old family acquaintance in the grocery store, and she was talking about her son and asking about your son. And then there was also your good friend who you had a breakfast or lunch with, who was was talking about their kid and getting piercings and things like that. And of course, for someone in your position, where your son was, some of these things seem rather mundane or bothersome even. And I thought, well, I can understand that, and yet I'm an outsider. What am I supposed, you know, what am I supposed to say to these people? And I mean, sincerely, I kind of wondered. I mean, as I recall, you didn't attack either of these people or hit the woman over the head with a loaf of bread or anything.
Right.
But, you know, and I think it was an honest, I appreciate an honest description from your end of things. But what should people do, or is there even an answer?
Let's see. I think those sections in the book that you're talking about, those feelings, they just stayed up here. And sometimes, like when you're, you know, when you're in a situation and you have a child in harm's way, I mean, and you know, who's really, you know, experiencing the things that Roman experienced and is in that situation, and then, you know, you encounter friends and they're talking about, you know, just normal stuff or they're excited about this or that. And part of me, I mean, I get it. I understand that. And I know you have every right to be proud of your son who just graduated from college or, you know, your daughter who's doing this or that. And I get that. But yet when you're in that situation, there's just something. It's hard to hear, you know, because you think, you know, you realize that your child is in, you know, in a situation they could die tomorrow. I mean, yeah. And the odds of that happening are much greater than you know, the friends that you encounter. So, I don't think I really held it against them, but it was just a feeling that would sort of bubble up.
You seem like a very nice person.
Yeah. So I wanted to include things like that because sometimes you do, you know, or you might feel a certain anger and frustration just at the whole situation, and it can bubble up in those sorts of ways. And I wanted, you know, when you write a memoir, you want to be honest, and
right.
And I think the thing that you were talking about, like what to reveal, you know, you can make that decision to reveal the things about yourself. But then when you're writing, there's other people that are in your story.
Right.
And there's always that question of, you know, you kind of want to respect their privacy, but yet you want to tell the truth.
Right.
And there's all those issues to, you know, to navigate as someone who writes a memoir.
So. You know, I'm wondering, too, Brian, you talked a little bit about this, but I'm curious about when you decided to serve and were preparing to serve and were preparing to deploy, did it occur to you that I'm going to be a very different person when I'm finished with this?
No. And I don't know if anybody could have told me, but I wish somebody would have tried.
Yeah.
Or maybe they did and I just didn't hear it. But that was that was one of the most challenging parts is this, is becoming such a different person when you get home and how transformed you are by the experience and how maybe your family's not ready for that or you're certainly not ready for that. And it's not, I guess it's a shock for everybody. And in mm-hmm. some, I've been asked a couple times, you know, I guess a similar question that you asked, Sue, like what should people, what should the average American who doesn't have a family member serving, what should they know? And I guess my answer to that has been, we can't expect any of these soldiers to come home the way they left.
Right.
You know, and I think that we sometimes just expect, well, just come on home and get a job and everything will work out fine. And but, you know, how many, your average 23-year-old in the United States doesn't have dead friends.
Right.
Unless they've been in the military. I mean, these kind of things are transforming. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I'm not sure if somebody could have told me, but that was part of the discovery process, I guess.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, there are a couple of things going on, including, you know, we have an all-volunteer military now, and so
right.
many people don't. You know, many people have not served, nor do they know anybody well who's served or in current times. You know, my father served, but I have three brothers, none of us served.
Right.
And so the connection is, I mean, these wars can go on almost as if they're not going on if you're living here disconnected from it all.
Yeah, I talk about this subject a little bit in other forums, and I've done some of the research, and I think it was Pew that did the surveys, and if you're age 50 or 60 or above, the chance that you have a family member, like immediate family member that served, is something like 70 or 80%. But if you're 30 or below, it's half that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so military service is becoming a family tradition.
Right.
Sons serve like their fathers. It's becoming a regional thing, and if basically, mm-hmm. unless you live in Lawton, Oklahoma, or Killeen, Texas, or Fayetteville, North Carolina, you just simply don't see people in the military. You don't see people in uniform, and you're less likely to have family members join.
Right.
And so there is this divide, and I don't. I'm not sure it serves society in general. I'm not sure it serves the military, and the bridging of it is challenging because the all-volunteer military is, I mean, it's really worked. So there's mm-hmm. it's events like this maybe that help bridge some of that.
I think your books certainly, you know, are part of that. But it also, I mean, this is not brilliant observation. You know, we're creating this whole generation that is going to be with us for a long time. Of, you know, with sort of this this misery of alphabet soup. You know, TBI and PTSD and you know, as we all know, good news, these blasts aren't killing as many people. The bad news is some of the people who survive are in pretty bad shape and are going to need some help and some understanding and that sort of thing. And this is going to go on for generations, I mean.
It is. There's two ways of looking at it. The RAND Corporation, I think we quoted the same study, actually, that something like 20% of returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan have some level of traumatic brain injury. Now, it's a spectrum like autism and a lot of other things. So you can have a very, very mild traumatic brain injury and just have memory problems or sleep problems, and then there are folks that need to learn to walk again. So there's mm-hmm. a huge, huge span. That's one challenge that society is going to have. The other one is we have 2 million veterans who chose to serve their country and are looking for another way to do it. And there, the number of veterans groups that are doing disaster relief in Haiti and are becoming teachers and are just doing so many other things because they want to keep serving and they're trying to figure out the way to do that. So I think there's a challenge and an opportunity, to use the cliche.
Yes. Well, no, that makes a lot of sense. It's a problem that's going to need, people are going to have to be very perceptive because it doesn't always make itself known immediately. And, at the same time, people need increased awareness. They're becoming farther removed from the military and from, therefore, from veterans. But, and from your end of things, Sue, I was wondering, after that IED incident, Roman became somewhat less communicative, and I was wondering, whether you were prepared for that sort of change.
I would say no, but in some way, yes, too. Mm-hmm. Roman's first deployment, he often communicated with us by instant messaging. So he would find a computer somewhere in Iraq, and all of a sudden we'd see that little thing pop up on our computers. And it seemed then that he would, my husband and I joked that he actually talked with us more when he was in Iraq than he did all through high school, So he always has been sort of a man or a boy of few words. He wasn't a big letter writer or anything like that. But then after, because of all those things that were happening, and it wasn't just the IED thing, it was other things that were happening in the platoon.
Right. Right.
There was one incident where their forward operating base burned down. So I think my son was out on patrol then, and he came back, and the place burned down. And so they had nothing. They lost all their pictures, their photos, their DVD players. Their ammunition was blowing up. I mean, they were out in their underwear with nothing and surrounded by. So, I mean, there was just a lot of stuff that doesn't usually happen, but that was happening to that particular group. And so my, letters virtually stopped for a while. And I can understand that, because I think in some ways it was impossible, or he didn't want to tell us the truth. He couldn't tell. He didn't want to tell us the truth. He wanted to spare us that. And he couldn't lie. He didn't want to lie. He refused to lie. And so those two things would explain why you wouldn't hear from somebody.
My mother didn't know most of the things that happened to me until she read my book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can't say it when you're there, and you have trouble saying it when you get back.
Yeah. And I know that you had said in your book that there are certain people that you come out to about the crazy.
Right.
And you said your wife, but not your mother.
Right.
Would you explain that, Brian?
I have a feeling no matter what I say, I'm going to be getting in trouble.
That's what we're here for.
I don't know. My wife had to live with me every day, but, my mother was, at first when I was, when we lived in Las Vegas, she was thousands of miles away. Eventually, at least she was in town, but I just didn't, I was protecting her,
mm-hmm.
Same way, mm-hmm. same thing, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say just quickly about communication.
Sure.
This is, Roman and I were there about the same time. I got home a little bit after him. End of 2006 may feel like a short time ago, but, we didn't have Facebook then.
Right.
And we didn't have, we didn't have a bunch of these internet tools. We didn't have social media, and, the phones were few and far between. So it's 6 years is almost an eternity in the communications world.
That's true, yeah. And it's really amazing to me. You wrote very candidly about your progression and coping mechanisms, which included at the beginning drinking and then moved on to yoga and running and some combination, I'm sure, of that. And I'm kind of wondering just how your relationships, particularly your marriage, how it survived that.
Oh, you should ask my wife, but she's here, but I'm not going to ask her.
Yeah, talk about getting in trouble. That's,
yeah. I'm out of batteries.
Oh. Tell you what.
Well, here I could lean over.
Yeah.
Why don't I interview you from here?
Oh, what was that?
I think he's calling for help.
I can't help that. Do you have
Oh, I couldn't find it because it's really hard to see. It's this big thing. Thank you.
Is this working? But yeah, that's working better. Sorry about that. Can I avoid the question, or I still have to answer?
I forgot what it was, but maybe you remember.
You know, when you about my wife and how did our marriage cope, and it was certainly, I mean, stressful doesn't even begin to describe it. I think when you write a memoir, and you probably agree, one of the most important things you have to do is decide what not to put in. What doesn't further the story. One piece of advice I got very early in the process was that, you know, because it all happened, your tendency is to put it all in. So the trick is, what do you crop out? And one of the big things I cropped out was marriage counseling, which we did, and we did a lot of. But that's not a quick and easy answer either. The truth is, it's still a struggle because the just like I say there's no cure for the crazy, well, that means that the implications or the fallout from that as being a father or a husband or a son, I mean, that never really ends either.
Right.
So it's kind of a constant thing. I keep it in perspective that I have so many friends who are so much worse off than I am, either physically, you know, missing limbs or their traumatic brain injury or whatever else, that the struggles in the marriage are not inconsequential, but in perspective, we're doing very well.
Well, good, good. I'm going to turn to our brilliant audience for some questions. I've been sending up these cards. The first I think you both might have perspective on. My son-in-law is active military, having served a tour in Iraq and another in Afghanistan. He's been back over a year and is still dealing with PTSD. As a soldier, he believes he needs to man up and deal with it on his own. How can we help him? How can we help him be willing to get help? That's a tough question, I'm sure, but if you have any thoughts.
Oh, go ahead.
I think that's the million-dollar question, and I don't have a good answer, and I don't think the VA has a good answer, and I don't think all the various veterans groups have the perfect answer, or we would have solved it yet. The thing that they're battling is that in the military you're taught self-sufficiency, and you're taught to take care of others first, think of others first, accomplish the mission, overcome all these obstacles, and for me, and I, my caveat is I can't speak for all veterans, of course, but for me, going crazy was failing at the mission, and I needed to fix that, you know, and I would take care of this on my own. You don't ask for help, you provide help.
Wow.
You know, in your call to service. And so it's not even a macho thing. It's just it's against your own vision of yourself, as of I'm here to serve others, not to accept other people's help.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so I think that all families can do is understand that, and if they do, maybe then knowing the particular veteran, they can know how to then best approach them.
Mm-hmm.
But understanding and patience are the answer to how my marriage stayed together is understanding and patience.
Uh-huh.
Now that I'm finally there.
Okay. And so I'm just wondering, you know, if you might have some thoughts on that.
I think that answer was very good, and the understanding and patience. I think too that there are programs that have been helpful. But the trick is to for the person to get to them,
right.
and to realize that might be a good thing. I think the occasional sort of nudge. And then patience too, because I think when people are ready, they're ready.
Mm-hmm.
I know. Yeah. I lead writing workshops for war veterans, and readiness is really a key thing. It can be very helpful and very therapeutic when you say, I want to do this, and I want to tell these stories, and I want to get those stories out there, and I want to put them on the page, and I want to lay my burden down that way. But it can be not so helpful if you're not ready to do it, and someone sort of forces you to do it too. So,
right.
it's a very difficult terrain, really.
I'm sure it's frustrating and heartbreaking. But, well, when you talk about writing as therapy, someone was asking Brian, but I'm going to morph this into a question for both of you. But this person wrote, "Thank you for your vivid description of your time in Iraq and afterwards. Did writing your story help with the crazy?" And I guess we'll start with you, Brian.
Yes, but I mean, the short answer is yes. But in writing, it was probably a catharsis in some way. However, I don't think anybody would have, like I kind of mentioned in the beginning, I don't think anybody would have wanted to read just a catharsis. And mm-hmm. So there was a balance between, I mean, I scribbled a lot of things down in a lot of notebooks that were helpful to me that nobody would want to read. Going through the writing process and having that product and then talking about it, I'm not sure that has fixed the crazy, in finger quotes, but it has. I don't know. One of the prime ingredients of the crazy is a complete lack of meaning and, mm-hmm. and like what I've already done, the most important thing I'm going to do in my life, which was go to war and keep all these men and women right. safe. What am I going to do now? And writing and sharing it provides an answer to that at least feels, well, maybe partway up the mountain.
Uh-huh. And so your book, I mean, you had to reconnect with a son and I'm sure other issues to deal with. Was it helpful to write this out?
I think it was helpful. I hoped that it would be helpful to other people. I mean, I didn't really do it. I wanted to shape those stories. I wanted to make them into a narrative. It wasn't writing. It wasn't journal writing. I mean, it was shaping a story. But I think writing, maybe for in your instance and in the writing workshops that I lead, if you can. When you put a story on paper and it has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and you take it to the next level of, you know, you write, this is what happened, but then you go a little bit deeper and you say, this is what it meant. That gives you, in some ways, sort of control over a situation that might have been chaotic. I mean, in writing a story, you can kind of triumph over that situation. And I think that's where it can be very helpful. Not just putting things down, but really trying to make it into a story. And then, even better, share that story with other people.
Mm-hmm. Well, that does bring us to our last question, which comes too soon for me. But I was wondering if you might talk a bit, we've talked about some of this, but about what you hope these books accomplish in terms of what sorts of conversations they might start, and what the bigger impact of them will be.
I know, I hoped when I was writing my book that other military families would see their own experiences mirrored in it. And when that happens, you feel less alone. And you might have thought, I'm the only one that felt this way. And then you read something and you say, well, no, you know, other people feel that way too. And I know one of the best, most meaningful compliments that that a writer can get is to hear from a reader say, your words were my words. And so that was something that I hoped for. And then I also hoped that people who didn't have someone in the military would, you know, that it would provide some insight into what that's like.
Mm-hmm.
And I really believe, like, if enough, you know, true stories are told, that we'll learn from that, and maybe we'll learn to live in peace together, you know, eventually.
Terrific. So.
I wish I had such altruistic motives. I mean, like I said, the truth is that I felt like I had the story that needed to get out. It was going to come out one way or the other. And then I didn't expect it to go anywhere. And the fact that it has, I mean, it's just, I wasn't trying to create a platform or have an mm-hmm. agenda. I was trying to tell a story that I thought was pretty average, I guess. So now that I'm here and I'm sitting here and we're doing this, I guess I really felt the need to explain, and so my only hope on the part of the reader is that understanding that Sue just said, which is, oh, this is what it feels like, and you have some sort of connection there. And then if that starts another conversation, if that gets families to start talking, I get some of the same notes, which is that, you know, from a father, I don't know what to say to my son when we're driving mm-hmm. the VA appointment together, but now I feel like I kind of understand a little bit. That's just, that's so overwhelming, I don't know what to do with that. Mm-hmm. So it's, if people are talking and there is some more understanding, then that's what I hope for.
Well, terrific. I think you're both well on your way, and you've done us a great service, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Share. Just bear with us for a moment. Go to the end. I think I'll put it up here. Okay. So I hope you all enjoyed this evening's program, and we really look forward to seeing you at future Silicon Valley Reads events. Again, we'd like to thank our 2013 Silicon Valley Reads authors, Brian Kastner, author of The Long Walk, A Story of War and the Life That Follows. And Sue Diaz, Minefields with a Heart, A Mother's Stories of a Son at War. And again, our wonderful moderator, Mike Cassidy, the columnist for the San Jose Mercury News. And all of our generous corporate and community sponsors, and all of you, especially all of you, for joining us this evening.